Eric and Continental, Ms. Kohlross.
May it please the court, counsel, Melinda Kohlross on behalf of Zurich American Insurance Company. This is an insurance coverage action brought by Taco Bell against two of its insurers, Zurich American and Continental. The underlying lawsuit giving rise to this action concerns Taco Bell's alleged misappropriation of the, quote, psycho chihuahua, end quote, advertising character and concept. The idea of a feisty chihuahua obsessed with Taco Bell food, created by Rent.
And has that suit been resolved? Taco Bell.
It's up on.
Or?
No, it's currently on appeal in the Sixth Circuit. That's my understanding. Yes, is that that's still ongoing.
But this case just concerns the litigation clause. Right?
That's exactly correct. This feisty chihuahua, the psycho chihuahua character, was created by Wrench LLC, and it was used by Taco Bell.
Do those costs include appellate costs?
I'm not certain that this case was on appeal in the Sixth Circuit at the time these orders were entered and these amounts were entered against Zurich and
I guess my question is whether or not the final cost of this litigation has been determined.
No, the final costs have not been determined.
You're just contesting whether you owe anything at all.
Well, we're contesting the amounts of the judgments that were entered against us to date. Obviously, prospectively, we don't know what else might be coming down the line as far as that's concerned. For today's argument, I wanted to focus the court's attention.
That doesn't affect our jurisdiction.
No, because there were Rule 54B findings in the orders that were entered. These were all summary judgments, so the court does have jurisdiction. For the three points of error that I'd like to focus the court's attention on today, first and foremost is the district court's ruling that the prior or first publication exclusion in the Zurich policy does not bar potential coverage for the Wrench claims, despite the fact that it's undisputed that Taco Bell began airing these psycho chihuahua commercials prior to the inception of
Zurich. But they weren't the same commercials.
They were not identical commercials.
Yeah, well, that's a big problem for you, I think. Prior publication sounds like, it sounds like it's designed for a situation where suppose Taco Bell had been sued for it was sued for copyright infringement, wasn't it? Suppose Taco Bell were a publisher of books and it's sued for copyright infringement. Suppose it turns out that the books had been published and distributed years before the insurance policy was issued, but later, some of them were in bookstores and they kept being sold and so on, and those were new acts of infringement, creating new liability. Well, that would be the prior publication. That would be a case in which the prior publication rule would protect the insurance company. But here, what you have is new books being published during the insurance period, and they're like the old books. And you're saying, well, if they're a lot like them, then there's no coverage. And that seems like a very spongy test and very unsatisfactory from an insured standpoint.
Well, I don't disagree with the first part of the discussion that you gave as far as the copyright, and there were copyright claims at issue here too, but assuming you had the identical book published prior to the policy inception and the identical book published after that, certainly I think we would all agree the prior publication exclusion would apply to preclude coverage. The situation that we have here, if we take your book example, I think would be, what if we took a chapter out of that book and we put it into a new book? You've still got a copyright infringement, and I submit the prior publication exclusion would still apply. here is the crux of the allegation. What is misappropriated is this psycho chihuahua, the feisty chihuahua obsessed with Taco Bell food. And that misappropriated advertising idea, advertising concept, is alleged to appear in every one of those commercials. And that's why we submit the prior publication exclusion
applies. In your chapter case, this new book that contains the new chapter might also contain fresh copyright infringements. And then there'd have to be some apportionment of damages. But you're denying all liability here.
Well, we have to remember this issue is resolved on summary judgment.
But if Taco Bell created any new misappropriation during the period when your insurance was in force, that new of misappropriation, that new tort, you would be responsible for that.
But
you couldn't defend against all the liability on the ground that some of it was prior.
Well, I think you're right on that, the way you've described it, but here we have the idea that's misappropriated, the psycho chihuahua, and then that psycho chihuahua appears in each of those commercials. The only thing that's changed is what we call like the storyline or the scenario. Is this the psycho chihuahua on the sidewalk? Is the psycho chihuahua in a car? You know, what is the psycho chihuahua doing? But that underlying the advertising concept is the obsession with Taco Bell food. And all that the advertising agency has done is put the chihuahua in a slightly different circumstance, and that's the new commercial. If there was an allegation that there was something other than the psycho chihuahua being obsessed with Taco Bell food and acting out that obsession, I agree with you.
Commercials in the insured period of your insurance did not involve any misappropriation that hadn't been done before the insurance, is that what you're saying?
That's right. The allegation
that's
in both...
That's critical to your position.
The allegation in both the original and the amended complaints is that it was this theme of the psycho chihuahua obsessed with Taco Bell food that was misappropriated. And then there were commercials using that theme, using that character, using that concept that occurred prior to our policy inception, and then that also occurred after our policy incepted. And
I just wanted you to finish that thought, because I had another question that's posing it a different... What if Taco Bell, after the inception of the Zurich policy, aired for the first time a psycho St. Bernard advertisement?
I think they would have coverage. I don't think the prior publication exclusion would apply, and that gets back right to the crux of your issue. It's the identity of that concept that makes the prior publication exclusion applicable. I think the psycho crazy St. Bernard, the exclusion would not apply.
I noticed you use psycho throughout this, and of course your opponents don't use the term psycho chihuahua. I don't know, when I've seen the commercials, whether... why it's characterized as a psycho.
Those are actually from the allegations of the complaint, both the original complaint brought by Wrench LLC and the amended. And I've keyed it into that. The complaint allegations, though, this isn't just my characterization of those commercials. These are the complaint allegations specifically stating that the psycho chihuahua appeared in this commercial at this time doing these activities. So that's where I've taken my fact from.
So what if the chihuahua is not psycho in the commercial?
If there was an allegation that it was not psycho, that it was something else, then again, I think the prior publication exclusion might not apply. But based upon the complaint allegations that we have in front of us that we analyze to determine whether the exclusion applies, it's psycho chihuahua throughout.
If we, getting back to the psycho St. Bernard, if someone other than Wrench came along and claimed misappropriation of the St. Bernard concept, should this court read the PPE to relate back to the psycho chihuahua ad since it's similar, and then deny Taco Bell coverage since the chihuahua concept predated the Zurich policy?
I don't believe so under those facts. I mean, it would be helpful to know more than that, but just the way you've described it, I don't believe so. Because here, what we're really focusing in on is the fact that it was a singular concept, that it was created by one entity, that it was misappropriated by Taco Bell, and that it was used repeatedly. If you got into a scenario where some other entity was claiming a violation, a misappropriation, or a copyright infringement, and it was a different type of dog, I think you're getting into a much grayer area. I think we're in a very black and white area based upon that concept appearing in all of those commercials.
Well, wouldn't it have been easier for the parties to define themselves what they think is similar material that will or won't be excluded under the PPE and defining what material is?
Well, I'm not sure that it would be, because obviously until you know the facts of the particular case, the language is supposed to be kind of broad and inclusive and necessarily speaks in terms of a general concept. But I do want to direct the court's attention to some of the cases and the definitions of material.
The complaint, I'm looking at pages 19 to 20 of the court's opinion, this court's opinion, says the complaint describes a variety of advertising ideas and concepts. And then this little paragraph, which is quoted from the complaint, the idea of a chihuahua popping his head out through a hole at the end of a commercial, etc. And then the court says that in the pre-coverage period, Taco Bell aired a single commercial utilizing two of the six advertising ideas enumerated above. And the other four were not. So I don't understand how your argument can be squared with the court's description.
Well, I'm not sure if the court's description is entirely accurate. The complaint allegations that we have are from the original and the amended complaint. And once again, you have these scenarios, and this is what the district court focused in on. They said
yes, there's scenarios, but look, the basic idea of this obsessed chihuahua, that of course continues through, but there are other subordinate ideas. So take the idea of a chihuahua. I've never seen these ads, so, but suppose a chihuahua popping his head out through a hole at the end of a commercial. This is an idea which, according to Wrench, is something that the law protects from being copied. Seems odd, but that's not an issue for us. Well, that idea was not copied by Taco Bell until the coverage period.
But again, you would have to parse out. I think when you read the complaints as a whole, and you read all of the paragraphs, you'll see that what's being alleged as the misappropriation is the general idea.
I don't think Wrench would agree to that. Wrench isn't going to put all its marbles in that basket. Wrench wants to identify as many original ideas, like the head popping out of the hole, as it can. That's
first.
What you get reading the complaint, and that suggests that there are additional new misappropriations during the coverage period.
Well, I believe, again, when you read the original and the amended complaints as a whole, that these are descriptions of the various commercials, but that the misappropriation is alleged to be that general concept. I'm not sure that some of these subordinate concepts would stand on their own, and I'm not sure that they're alleged to be.
The duty to defend doesn't allow it, you know, doesn't permit us to, you know, predict how a court would treat all these allegations.
No, but we do need to look at the complaint allegations, and again, I will stress to the court that I believe this is a singular concept that has been misappropriated, and it's not multiple concepts misappropriated. And I see that my light is on. I just wanted to turn very quickly to one, our second and third issues. The second issue is the court's finding that there were no material fact questions as to the reasonableness of the alleged defense costs.
we argue that the Meckler report does give rise to material fact questions. And the third issue is the application of the SIR. The district court, there was a $2 million SIR under Zurich's policy. There was no similar SIR under the Continental policy, yet the district court said that both policies' defense obligations incepted at the $2 million mark. And we maintain that that is incorrect. Only Zurich is entitled to the benefit of its SIR, and that's detailed at length in our brief.
Can I ask you just a question about one of the other issues?
Absolutely.
I didn't understand the notice issue. If you had gotten earlier notice of the wrench suit, what would you have done?
Well,
different from what you did do.
Again, that's always a hindsight determination. But based upon the complaint allegations, it appears that there may have been prejudice to us that we might have been able to do something to stop these continuing commercials and
what?
The additional damages.
I don't understand that you could have done something. You didn't reserve in your insurance policy. Did you control over Taco Bell's advertising campaign?
No, absolutely
not.
So
how could you tell them to stop?
We wouldn't have been able to enforce that. We wouldn't have been able to control that.
So what would you have done? Go to them and say, we're really worried that we might have to pay on your insurance policy, and we don't like to do that.
I don't believe that's unreasonable to say.
Really?
Yes, that these liabilities are amounting to say you've already been accused of a misappropriation, you have litigation that's
Taco
been
Bell
filed against
well
you.
That,
Taco Bell could have refused. That's entirely possible.
Call off the dog.
Well, so to speak.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Colroy. Mr. Bruton, are you Continental? Okay. Maybe you can explain what Continental's appeal is about. I didn't really understand that from the papers.
Yes, Your Honor. We, on our cross-appeal, we raised two issues. The first relates to the judgment that was entered against Continental in favor of Taco Bell. And our position is that judgment was improperly entered because at the time the judgment was entered, the dispute on the duty to defend between Continental and Taco Bell,
I thought you settled that,
had been resolved. That
so,
is correct.
So what do you care about whether it's a judgment or not?
Well, we do care, Your Honor. There's a judgment in a federal district
court. Well, why do you care?
Because there is a document in a federal
district court. You settled, right?
That's right. The judgment doesn't say.
Settled, you paid them. So what is the judgment?
Well, the judgment doesn't say that the judgment is subject to a settlement agreement that's not part of the court's record. The judgment simply says that we have a duty to defend Taco Bell. And that was resolved prior to the time the judgment was entered. If a third party were to search the court records, the third party would find a judgment against
So you just Continental. You just want this judgment
vacated.
Does Taco Bell care?
I think that's a good question to ask counsel for Taco Bell, but
well,
I can't say that.
But
that
sure, we've discussed that
yes,
with
we have.
Them before.
Yes,
right?
We have. And
so
it's
what
my,
do they say?
It's my understanding that they will acknowledge they were not seeking any relief from Continental at the time that the judgment was entered. And I think they would agree that the court probably did not need to enter that
so
judgment.
Why is this an issue for us? I don't understand. Can't you settle those things on your own?
I don't think the judgment can be vacated, however, without an order from this court to be applied by the district
court. And that's my question. So did you go to the district court and ask the district court to vacate the judgment?
What we did, Your Honor, and this can be found in the record at page 112, is at the time that a proposed judgment was offered, there was language in the judgment that suggested that there would be a judgment in favor of Taco Bell and against Continental. And in a reply memorandum in support of that motion, we objected to the inclusion of that language for the very reason that we've objected here on appeal. And that objection can be found in our supplemental record at page 77. So we did ask the district court not to enter that judgment. Nevertheless, the district court went ahead.
And did you ask the district court not to enter it because there had been a settlement and
correct.
It had been resolved?
Correct.
And then once the district court entered the judgment, did you ask the district court to reconsider?
We did not. Once it was entered, we recognized there would be issues on appeal, and we elected not to take another step in further delaying the appellate process. But I don't believe we waived any objection to the entry of the judgment because we did object to it at the time that the court was considering.
And you argued to the district court that it was moot given that you had already settled it.
That's correct.
And say again why you don't want to have that judgment of record.
Because first of all, one of the things we bargained for as part of our settlement was withdrawal of the motions for summary judgment. A third party can come to the district court here and look up this case and can find that there is a judgment that suggests that judgment was entered against Continental in the favor of Taco Bell. There's no explanation in that judgment that, well, in fact, there was a resolution of the duty issue before the court rendered that judgment.
But
a third party who looked at the cold court record would not recognize that. And I think that it's improper. And
what's a third party to any?
Yeah, how does that harm Continental?
Well, I don't know right here as we stand here today. Okay? And that's an honest answer because I can't speculate as to what third parties might do with a judgment. What might do in a subsequent case, perhaps, that involves some kind of similar issues where they might say, look, judgment was
coverage issue. In other words, they're going to come back and say, look, Continental refused, but they lost, and they're forced to extend coverage, right?
And I don't think anyone can anticipate exactly how that judgment might be used to the detriment of Continental in the future. Our point is simply it was improperly entered, and it ought to be vacated.
What other issue did you... You said you had two issues.
Yes, and the second issue relates to the amount that Zurich should be required to reimburse Continental. Clearly, the district court found that Zurich had a duty to defend.
Reimbursed from whom? You have a settlement with Taco Bell.
We have a settlement with Taco Bell, and we're not seeking reimbursement from Taco Bell.
We're seeking something from Zurich?
That's correct, and in fact, the district court ordered Zurich to reimburse Continental for 50% of the fees and costs that Continental had paid.
And you want more?
We think we're entitled to more. That is correct.
Well, doesn't your argument in defense of the 50-50 split neglect or overlook Continental's duty to defend, which, unlike Zurich, was triggered from the outset of the covered occurrence?
We make two distinct arguments on why we're entitled to more than 50%. One is that Continental did not have a duty to defend. The district court rejected that argument, but we maintain on appeal that if you look at the allegations in the amended complaint, the focus of those allegations was clearly the national campaign.
Oh, please. So you and Ms. Kohlroz are making equally and opposite untenable arguments about the Wrench complaint.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that...
Just look at the complaint. There's nothing in the complaint that supports what you're saying.
The complaint identifies the fact that
there were... There are dates in the complaint.
There are some dates in the complaint.
Not in the part that discusses misappropriation.
Well, there's clearly some activity that occurs during the Continental policy period. There's no question about that.
Well, wasn't the 1997 commercial just as much a misappropriation as the 1998 national campaign and the injury to Wrench?
I think the question is, what was Wrench complaining about?
Well, right, Wrench was complaining about the Chihuahua.
Why on earth would they give up their 1997 complaint? Terrible arguments, really.
The focus, there's no question that
the focus doesn't matter. Your duty is to defend against anything within the scope of the complaint. You're not allowed to predict that the plaintiffs are going to focus on some subset of their allegations.
The
happens to be completely implausible also what you're saying. Why on earth would they give up part of their claim?
If you look at the way they presented their claim...
What's the way they presented their claim? We have a complaint and an amended complaint.
And we
don't parse it and try to figure out their trial strategy from the way they phrased it.
And we also have the motion for
wrong.
A temporary restraining
That's
order,
wrong.
Which was filed between the complaint and the amended complaint, and clearly argues that the injury will occur when the national campaign runs out.
Well, of course, if they want a temporary restraining order, they have to say imminent injury. You can't get a temporary restraining order if the injury has already occurred.
That's correct, and that's why
the... Go on and explain. Now, why is it you think you're entitled to more of the, a larger share of the litigation expense than 50%?
The second reason is that we are attempting, obviously, to only allocate the defense costs that have been incurred. Courts have said, and this is the Knoll Court is a good example of a district court case from the Northern District of Illinois. In an advertising injury case, the court looked at the defense costs and said, can we allocate those between and among the various advertisements that may have occurred? And the court concluded that you could not. It was impossible to allocate those defense costs in any way meaningful to the terms of the policy. Therefore, the court said, under those circumstances, the appropriate allocation is time on the risk. Now, the allocation may be very different when we talk about the duty to indemnify, which is a distinct and separate duty under the policy. But for the purposes of allocating the defense costs, much like the court did in Knoll...
Why? I don't get it. Well, I don't understand. Why wouldn't one expect the allocation of defense costs to be similar to the allocation of indemnity?
The standards of whether there is an obligation to defend or an obligation to indemnify are very different standards.
Oh, sure, it's broader for the defense, but I don't understand why the allocation formula should be different.
Because when you're talking about the defense costs, if there's any possibility of coverage, you're required to defend all the claims, whether they ultimately are found to be covered or not.
Right.
When you're talking about...
Yes, I understand. So what does that have to do with time on the risk?
Well, what it has to do with it is when you're looking at the defense costs and trying to allocate those, and you cannot meaningfully allocate them to anything that's covered particularly by each policy. In this case, the individual separate advertisements that occurred at different periods of time.
Right.
You can't allocate that when you're looking at the defense costs, because it's impossible to know what defense costs were paid for whatever.
You can't allocate it from the standpoint of indemnity either.
I believe you can, and that's the issue.
Not as a practical matter.
That's the issue before the Circuit Court of Cook County, is whether you can allocate.
That's very difficult.
If I may just very quickly finish. Our position is that
the time business, time on the risk, that seems completely arbitrary.
Well,
it's completely arbitrary. It has nothing to do with anything.
We insured Taco Bell for 2 months when these commercials happened.
Sure, 2 months, but if in that 2 months, according to Ms. Kohlroth, it was in that 2 months that all the damage was done. So naturally, you'd be expected to bear the lion's share of the, if she were right, the lion's share of the defense costs. Anyway, what about this $2 million? Now, in effect, the court gave you a piece of that $2 million, didn't it?
I don't think it did, Your Honor.
The policy... That $2 million is just Zurich's, right?
Well, what the Zurich policy says is that $2 million must be paid by Taco Bell.
Right.
$2 million was paid by Taco Bell.
But that's for the benefit of Zurich, not for the benefit of another insurance company.
The Zurich policy doesn't say...
Oh, come on. Why would Zurich want another insurance policy to benefit from the retention?
Your Honor, that's not the issue. The issue is what was required in order to trigger that duty to defend. And
yeah,
payment
but your duty
million.
To defend was triggered from the outset, while Zurich would not kick in until Taco Bell paid $2 million. So crediting you with half of Zurich's amount would award to $1 million windfall to Continental. I mean, just...
I think we also have to look at the context in which the amount was set for the judgment against Zurich. Very briefly, what happened was the court granted summary judgment and did not initially set an amount, because at that time defense costs were ongoing. They're still ongoing. After the court granted summary judgment, Continental submitted an affidavit establishing how much it had paid to the date of the court's order. And that affidavit established that Continental had paid a little over $3.5 million. And as a result, Continental asked that it be awarded one half of that amount that it had paid, which amounted to a little over $1.7 million. It's clear from the record that Zurich never objected to that amount. In fact, in the court's opinion directing the entry of judgment, the court said, this amount is based upon the uncontested affidavit submitted by Continental. And in the judgment itself, it says this $1.7 million amount is based upon the uncontested affidavit. I submit to this court that if there was any question in Zurich's mind about whether the self-insured retention had been properly applied or not, when Continental did its calculations and submitted specific numbers that it wanted the court to enter judgment on, Zurich should have objected at that point in time.
So you're arguing forfeiture?
Arguing waiver, Your Honor, on that issue.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Bruce.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Schoen?
Thank you, Your Honors. Gene Schoen on behalf of Plaintiff Appellee Taco Bell. First, I plan to address two issues, which are the prior publication issue as well as the reasonableness of the fees issue, or at least focus my argument there. But I want to follow up on something that Mr. Bruton said at the beginning, and that's Taco Bell's posture as to the cross-appeal of Continental. Now, we don't think that Judge Leinenweber erred by entering the judgment that he did, but it should be very clear that we have no dispute with Continental with respect to the duty to defend in this case. Our relationship is governed by a separate settlement agreement and was at the time that Judge Leinenweber entered his judgment.
Well, what about this judgment? They want the judgment removed. Do you have any objection to that?
Seriously, Your Honor, I don't. We believe that Judge Leinenweber correctly entered the judgment. I'll qualify it in this sense. At the time, I believe that the judgment that we tendered qualified any judgment against Continental to be so that its obligations were subject to our separate settlement agreement. And I think the district court found its own way to enter the judgment.
But now, if a case goes to judgment and then it's settled, is it customary to vacate the judgment?
In my practice, it's customary. I understand that there are some courts where it is not.
Well, the court loses jurisdiction to enforce the settlement agreement, though, right?
That's correct. Unless but you specifically reserve, right. The court specifically
but
reserved.
But it's been paid, right? So that's not a...
It's an ongoing obligation.
Well, they have an ongoing obligation to defend continuing on your appeal, right?
That's correct. And they are continuing to do so.
But if they stopped, you don't have a judgment to go back to. Or you do have now have a judgment to go back to seek enforcement, right?
I would have a breach of contract claim, right. And potentially in that agreement, which is not before the
but
court,
you're
not
I don't
want to get into
that,
a lot of detail here, but it could be voided and we'd be back to where we were. So, but I did want to clear the air on that. And another just point is, I think somebody said that there were copyright claims in the underlying case. There are no copyright claims. These are misappropriation
mm-hmm.
claims.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that that's material to the court's consideration. But as for the prior publication exclusion itself, there's obviously a lot of wrangling back and forth on how that should be applied under these circumstances where you have one instantiation of this chihuahua in a test commercial in July of 1997 during period one, and then a major campaign that's launched thereafter, if that's the way you read the complaint. Now, fortunately, I think for our purposes today, you don't have to resolve all of the intricacies of how that prior publication exclusion would be applied, because it's Zurich's burden here to demonstrate, as it was in the district court, that the application of that exclusion is unambiguous, that it is clear, and that it is free from doubt. As Zurich's counsel is arguing this here this morning, Zurich is pushing very hard on the idea that what material should mean in this exclusion is the concept or the idea. And the problem I think that gets them to, if you push it too hard, is then you have to ignore the rest of the language of the exclusion, because that exclusion does not talk about concepts or ideas. It talks about material.
Well, of course,
but it's
with privacy, the reason I started off by asking about copyright is that prior publication language in the policy seems more oriented toward copyright or toward libel than toward misappropriation. But the misappropriation is so spongy, you have an idea. And her, Ms. Kohlross's argument is that what was, that the misappropriation in effect was complete in 97. And then the what happened subsequently is various uses of the idea, but they're sort of not fresh misappropriations, they're just fresh utilizations of the stolen property. That's her analogy to the chapter. You stole the chapter, you put it in a bunch of different anthologies, mm-hmm. but it's the same chapter. So this is the same idea.
And the copyright analogy may be apt here because it seems to track a little bit more carefully the language of the exclusion, which talks about written or oral publication. Now, I advanced an argument in my brief. I didn't do very well with Judge Leinweber on that argument, but I raise it again simply because it does put in and uses all of the language. What Ms. Kohlross's, what Zurich's argument ignores in its in pushing this idea of concept is the oral or written portion of the exclusion. And this complaint doesn't allege that anything was oral or written. It talks about a commercial. We don't know whether it was oral, written, or whatever. It was some kind of a manifestation. But that's, I mean, a kind of, that's where that argument pushes you. It's not one that we advanced below, but it's where that argument pushes you. The other place that that argument pushes you is it ignores the preface, which is the initial language before you get to prior publication is, this insurance does not apply to personal or advertising injury arising out of. Well, that means to me that it's not any prior publication. After all, it could have been that that test commercial was approved by Wrench. In fact, it wasn't approved, but there's some indication that potentially it was acquiesced in some way. Well, that would be a prior publication, but it would not be the basis on which the claim arises. So there are two additional problems that the Zurich argument introduces by going with the language of concept instead of sticking with what Judge Leinenweber did in this case, and we think correctly, and that was looked at how is this actually alleged in the complaint, and then judging it from that standpoint. And
how many separate commercials were there?
The complaint alleges 12 additional commercials. I believe five
after
were alleged.
After this pilot one?
Yes, it's not entirely clear. It talks about a activity in October of 1997, which just happens to be when you have the policy changeover where five additional commercials came up. And I think the second amended complaint talks about 12 others. I really don't have anything else to add on the prior publication exclusion, which was...
Can you turn to the reasonableness of defense costs, the arguments, and the Kaiser standard, and how would application of the Kaiser standard affect the assessment of reasonableness of defense costs to Taco Bell incurred in the Wrench action? Can you meet the requirements of Kaiser, I guess is my bottom line.
My bottom line on that one is it depends on how you read Kaiser. If you read Kaiser in light of Belcourt, this court's decisions in Belcourt and Medcom, yes. If you read Kaiser exactly as it was applied in Kaiser, the answer to that is no, because there the court requires or seems to require a line-by-line examination. But let me back up, because I really think that Zurich has misstated what the issue here is. It's not whether or not the so-called Meckler report created an issue of fact. The issue is whether the district court chose the correct standard, because there's no doubt about it that once Judge Leinenweber chose the Belcour Medcom commercially reasonable standard, that it was correctly applied. And let me explain why. First of all, at the time that he chose that standard, it was when there were motions for partial summary judgment. And the only issue as to the defense cost as of that point were, had Taco Bell spent more than $2 million, the SIR amount. At the time, what Judge Lina Weber had before him was the affidavit of Mr. Keith from CNA, in which not only does he say the total amount that CNA had paid, which was somewhere in the range of $3.5 million, but Mr. Keith's affidavit also says that CNA had paid $2,029,000 during the period of time from January of 1998 through October of 1999. And this is really important, I think, in understanding how Judge Leinweber can conclude that Taco Bell had incurred at least $2 million worth of expenses. So not only do you have Taco Bell, which with our own affidavit attesting to some $5 million in total, you also have CNA, who after all is in the business of paying attorneys and determining reasonableness of fees, has already paid over $2 million as of that time. And on top of that, collectively, what Judge Lina Weber says is, I don't have to decide at this point how much is owed to Taco Bell or how much is owed to Continental. What I can say is that more than $2 million representing the SIR has been incurred. The next thing that happens is we try to liquidate that judgment. And on behalf of Taco Bell, I submitted a further affidavit requesting fees. And Judge Lina Weber said, well, wait a minute. You haven't given the bills to Zurich. I adopted the commercially reasonable standard, but that means something. It means that there's some review here. So what happened, and this is in the record, in the supplemental in the appendix to Zurich's brief, is there was a period of negotiation with Zurich to the point where when the final judgment was entered awarding Taco Bell fees, the amount was agreed upon under the commercially reasonable standard. No objections were filed, even though they were invited by Judge Leinweber. And all Zurich preserved from that point forward was the argument that Judge Leinweber chose the wrong standard. Now let me address the standard. I'm sorry for the long-winded background here, Your Honor. But I think that Judge Leinweber, it's impossible for me to see how you could argue that he committed error by following this court's decisions in Medcom and Balcor and Judge Castillo's decision in Knoll 2, which followed essentially the same rationale. Especially in that context where his first decision is only has Taco Bell, in fact, approved or paid, rather, $2 million in attorney's fees. Now, is it possible to reconcile everything in Kaiser with Medcom and Belcourt? I think the answer to that is probably no, because Medcom, or rather Kaiser, says a lot of things that courts should do or should consider and so on. But I read the fundamental holding of Kaiser as being consistent with Medcom. In this respect, what Kaiser stands for in the Illinois Appellate Court is that the decision on awarding defense costs rests within the discretion of the trial court, and that discretion will not be disturbed absent some abuse. If you read Rollprint, which was the next decision from that court, in fact, the Rollprint court was still affirming the trial court decision, but it didn't undertake the same kind of review as was dictated in Kaiser either. And then subsequent decisions, likewise, I believe, even from this court, there was a decision in which there was some intermediate standard of review.
Now, I have a question about the attorney's fees, too, because when you look at the Illinois Intermediate Court, they pretty much applied the American rule, and you're familiar with our Green case, where absent bad faith, the insurer pays. And so the question is, should we depart from our precedent in Green, given how things have developed at the Illinois appellate court level, and should we do that because our being consistent with Green might pose a detriment to the coherence and consistency in the law, which is the standard?
Yes, Your Honor. In Green, of course, versus JCPenney, the court was predicting, based upon a split at that point between the 1st and the 5th District. And the court predicted that if the Illinois Supreme Court would rule on the issue, it would follow the Trevelyan case from the 5th District. Subsequent to that, this court addressed the issue again in National Cycle in a decision by Judge Easterbrook, who noted that Trevelyan had not gained any traction elsewhere in the Illinois appellate court, but still was the law within this circuit, and decided again to apply the Green standard for awarding of attorney's fees. And this has come up in other contexts as well. I would have to say that since even National Cycle, there's probably less evidence that the at the appellate court level as to what the Illinois standard would be, and more in favor of what Zurich would say. But whether this court departs from its prior precedent.
Well, wait, I've lost you. I mean, if we have made a mistake about Illinois law, then of course we should correct it, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Yeah. So shouldn't we follow the Kaiser case?
Now going back to Kaiser, I believe.
Well, follow whatever.
Oh, Green. The post Trevelyan decisions,
right,
from the appellate court. Again, Your Honor, at this point in time, the Illinois Supreme Court has not spoken. So
I know, but if our earlier decisions were based on a split, and usually if the Illinois appellate court is unanimous, we were not bound to say that the Illinois Supreme Court would agree. But there's a presumption that a unanimous Illinois appellate court decision states Illinois law correctly. So once that happens, once there is unanimity, why should we have any reluctance to change course?
Your Honor, it's a fair point, and it's obviously something that probably would have been decided differently today if the case came up for the first time, and I would not argue to the contrary. I will say that the reasoning behind Trevelyan, we continue to believe, is sound and can be supported.
Let me ask you about this notice thing. Now, granted, I would miss Ms. Kohlroth, that doesn't seem there was any prejudice from the late notice to Zurich. But on the other hand, they have this provision in there in the policy that they don't need to show prejudice. So why doesn't that mean the policy establishes a strict rule of forfeiture, you know, if you don't notify them immediately when you're sued?
Well, I think Judge Leidenweber addressed that correctly by saying that just because it is not their burden to show prejudice, it does not automatically mean that prejudice is irrelevant to the question. And here the absence of prejudice is manifest, as he pointed out in his opinion, as we know from the way the case developed thereafter.
Getting back to the Green situation, given how there is unanimity, there's no reason for us to certify the question to the Supreme Court, is there?
No, Your Honor. I whatever this court's decision is, your operating procedures, as I understand it, would require you to circulate, but within the court. But we are not advocating that this question be certified.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schoon. Ms. Kohlroth, how much time does she have? 3 minutes? 4 minutes?
I'll speak quickly. First of all, I wanted to address the argument made by Continental that Zurich waived its entitlement to the full benefit of the $2 million SIR. We did argue in our opposition to Continental's summary judgment motion that that is precisely what should occur, that we received the exclusive benefit of the $2 million, that Taco Bell had to pay its $2 million, and Continental had to pay $2 million before you got into this 50-50 apportionment. That's record document 88 at pages 12 to 13. Now, after the court ruled against us and said it's going to incept at the $2 million level, that's when that affidavit came in about what amounts Continental had paid out, and that was, I guess, technically an uncontroverted affidavit because we didn't argue that they did not spend that money, but that does not mean we agreed about how the judge set the allocation. So I just wanted to make sure that we were straight on that. As far as the issue on the defense costs, we submit that if you follow Kaiser and the standards set forth in Kaiser, we at least have a material question of fact here as to the reasonableness of the defense cost. Not just that they met the $2 million SIR, but the exact dollar amounts that were entered in judgment against us. The Meckler report sets out things that are overhead items, things that are defense non-defense items that you cannot properly recover.
offer, and we submit.
And now, your argument in your brief on that point is extremely short, and so why did the district court reject the Meckler report?
They said that you could not consider the Meckler report under the standard as enunciated in MedCom and Balcor, because the Meckler report did more than a general aggregate overview of the defense costs. It actually, or alleged defense costs, it actually examined what those bills were. And I submit to the court that if you take a literal reading of MedCom and Balcor, that even if there was a mathematical error, as long as the aggregate was okay, you could never challenge that, and that just doesn't make sense. That's part of what the Meckler report does, is say, you know, some of these things are not defense costs. There was a cost about Taco Bell doing an indemnity action against its advertising agency. You can't charge that against Zurich. That's not a defense cost. And the district court said we can't look at any of that. It just rejected the Meckler report entirely because it said you couldn't consider the Meckler report under MedCom and Balcor. And I submit that exact type of evidence in an affidavit was submitted to the court in roll print and resulted in a significant reduction.
Rollprint is the Illinois appellate court decision that eliminated this split.
No, Rollprint is the decision applying the Kaiser factors in assessing the duty to defend, how much of alleged defense costs expended in a breach of duty to defend case the insured could recover, and there was an affidavit adduced that stated these items are not proper defense costs, and the trial court said, we agree, we're going to reduce them by several $100,000. That was affirmed on appeal by the Illinois Appellate Court applying the Kaiser factors. And we argue that if you follow those cases here, that the Meckler report at least raises the question of fact. I think you're very in tune on the issue of the deck action fees, that Green, although correct at its time, or at least arguably correct, the split is gone, there's uniformity, there's a number of decisions in under Illinois law that they cannot recover their fees for the declaratory judgment action. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to all counsel. And we'll move